Mom and I did group one. What we learned about worship was David danced in worship. People shouted and they made lots of noise.
Jim, is your...
No, it's not. I'll say that all again.
Yes, okay. And so what we learned in the 2 Samuel 6, 12 to 15 about worship was that David danced as part of his worship with all his might. So it wasn't just like a little subtle thing. It was very energetic and passionate.
And that made God very happy.
Yep. And people shouted and they made noise. They had horns, so they had music. So one thing we learned about worship there is it can be expressed through physical movement, through art, and through noise. Mm-hmm. Who did Beth? 1 Chronicles 16, 8 to 36. And where can you share and do the mic?
Kathleen's going to be our sharer, so okay. I'm turning that so you can see her face.
Okay.
Let me turn her up.
Put the mic up to her face.
All right, we're ready. I have the microphone ready.
So, can you hear me through the microphone, though?
Yeah, we're just using the microphone to record.
Nobody's not.
Yeah, we can hear you. We're using it to record. Jerry's
okay, well...
But it's loud. You're loud enough.
Okay. Well, what we looked at is we found a lot of action verbs. Commands is what we call them.
And can you tell us what passage we did for the recording?
Sorry. We did 1 Chronicles 16, 8 through 36.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found in this passage is a lot of action words. And sometimes these had elaborations with it. But so we said, give thanks, call upon his name or address God, sing his praises, rejoice. We had some problems with glory in his name, but we said that we thought it had to do with rejoicing in the Lord was because they were together. Speak, seek the Lord and continually. With energy and not sporadic, we thought that meant intentional. Remember, and there's a list of at least three things we can remember there. Sing of his salvation from day to day. Declare, there's a bunch of things that you can declare about God. They're all listed. Bring offering to God. And then tremble before him, which we defined as realizing his greatness, acknowledging his presence. And realizing his greatness. And when those action verbs, when we do those things, then all creation worships the creator because we're saying the Lord reigns. And then you get the trees and the water and the, everybody's worshiping. All creation is also worshiping, which is just kind of a side note. But also give thanks for his steadfast love endures forever. Then after all of those action verbs, is the first time we get ask something of the Lord. And the last thing that we were, so the asking comes after all of the rest of that.
And that's in verse 35.
Yeah, verse 35. And also we said that everything here is about God. It is not about us. And so some of the songs that we sing is talking about us and our experience with God or whatever, but there's no I in this whole thing ever.
Mm-hmm.
Or good. Even we, I mean, when you get to the end, they have a specific prayer request for saving them from the nations. But the people all said amen and praised the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Good. Very good. Okay, Steve and Jerry, give them the microphone, whoever's the...
Steve does better notes than I do.
Use the microphone, Steve.
We had Psalm 104, and It seems Psalm 104.
Psalm 104.
Where's that? Oh, that's group 4.
Yeah, 4. I got, yeah. I skipped Gaetano and Shelley.
Do you want to go to them next?
Yeah, let's go back to group 3, Gaetano and Shelley.
Okay.
I saw the SC and thought.
I already talked enough.
Steve Cook, but it was Shelley Cook.
Are you sure? Shelley just told you everything to say.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Shelley and I noticed a few things that, and it's kind of a combination of things that were already mentioned, kind of this idea that when we're full of worship, it can be expressed in different ways. It starts off in the beginning with shout for joy to the Lord, give thanks to the Lord, make melody unto him with harp of 10 strings, sing to him a new song, play skillfully on the strings with loud shouts. So clearly, worship and praise can be expressed in different ways. And in this particular way, it's supposed to be to song. But then what we noticed was that the object or the thing that was supposed to stir up that emotion or that feeling and just that sense of worship, whatever that actually is in us, that worship is stirred up through meditating and acknowledging and speaking of his wondrous deeds and what he has done. So it's talking about, like, I highlighted a bunch of things that it talks about. For the word of the Lord is upright, all of his works are done in faithfulness. So then I highlighted, like, he loves, because of him, the heavens were made, by the breath of his mouth. He gathers, he puts in the deeps, for he spoke, he commanded, the Lord brings, he frustrates. His counsel stands forever. He has chosen as his heritage. He looks down from heaven. He sees. He looks out. He fashions. He observes. The eyes of the Lord are on those who fear him. And so it's just this, it's a constant acknowledgement of who he is. And who he is brings forth worship. And so we talked about, for example, this ties in that idea of praise can be expressed differently, but it's usually some form of exclaiming someone's greatness. So like if your grandma goes out to brunch with all of her friends and you did really good in school and you got, you know, you really got it going on at that time, you know, she'd be like, oh, my grandson, you know, he got good grades, he's doing great in sports. And then you see someone, they say, oh, we got brunch with your grandma, and she couldn't stop singing your praises over, you know, about all the things that are going on in your life. So she wasn't literally singing, but that's an expression because she's just talking about how amazing she thinks you are. And so that's what we ought to do with the Lord is talk about how awesome he is. And that is a form of worship expressed through that way. So
yeah, good.
So anyways.
Excellent.
Yeah. Anything? Thank you.
Are you sure? That's good.
That was great.
Hand it to Steve. And you're doing, say what verses you're doing, Steve.
We're doing Psalm 104. Jerry and I, who looked this up. It's a long passage, but what over and over again, it's talking about his majesty and his greatness. I mean, it's you did this, you did this, you did this, you created this, you then went ahead and did this. So it's over and over again. It's just going over all these different things. The key verse, I think, is at the very end to give us he says, I will sing to the Lord. Everything is what God did. At the very end, a response. He has a response. We don't know who wrote this. They think it's David, but it's not really clear. In 33, it says, I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. May my meditation be pleasing to him, for I rejoice in the Lord. So I think, to me, if I had to summarize what worship is based on these verses, Worship is meditating on his sovereignty, his majesty, his wonders, his provisions, his order, his sustaining of the earth. And so, I mean, man's only mentioned a little bit in here, it's all the other part of creation. Mm-hmm. He does mention man towards the end and says, where's the man part? Wrote that down. It's interesting. Everything else is great, but then at the very end he talks about...
But he does mention man a little bit in 14 and 15.
Yeah. And then 23 says, man goes out to his work and to his labor until evening, which is interesting how that fits into everything else. But I think he's pleased when we sort of talk about these things and we recognize what he's done. You know, a lot of times we forget when we walk outside, we look at all the wonders, we sort of explain them away, but we don't really say, God, you did this, you created this. Mm-hmm. And by just doing that, that is a form of worship. Mm-hmm. We see that as worship. And that's what David, who the writer, is doing here. He's just recognizing his works, all the wonderful things. And by doing that, he brings God pleasure by doing that.
Good. Very good. Okay, Mildred, pass the mic to Mildred.
You can turn the iPad so they can see her. Thank you.
They're going to get a headache from all this moving around.
Are you getting dizzy yet?
Hello.
Okay, this is for Psalm 111. And I worked in a group by myself, so there was no dissension at all. So I saw that the worship can and should include praise and thanks, remembering his wondrous works and delighting in his works. And I got to wondering, because the word covenant is mentioned twice in verse 5 and verse 9, which covenant were they talking about here? So I look some up, and it talks about in verse 5, he provides food for those who fear him. He remembers his covenant forever. So according to John MacArthur, that refers back to God providing food for Jacob and all of his family through Joseph, who went to Egypt before them. But that is the Abrahamic covenant, a promise that the nation will be more numerous than the stars. And it will be a covenant that lasts forever. And again, in verse 9, it mentions the covenant. And there again, it is the Abrahamic covenant, which is forever. He sent redemption to his people through Abraham, and he commanded his covenant forever. And the word forever is used multiple times all through this. His righteousness endures, his covenant endures. And his praise, the last verse, his praise endures forever. Mm-hmm. So it mentions many of his attributes. He's gracious, merciful, faithful, just, trustworthy, upright, and righteous. So those are all things that we can include in our worship as praise for God. But I did want to come back to the word fear, which I heard somewhere else people talking about fear. Because in verse 10, it talks about the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But it's not the fear of being afraid. It's awe, respect, and reverence. So that sums it up. Good. We need to have all those things for our worship.
Good. Good. Yeah.
Thank you, Shelley.
Okay. Jane and I did Malachi 1, 6 to 14. Do you want to say anything? Or do you want me to do it? Okay. So what we saw in Malachi 1, 6 to 14 is that God's standards of holiness require worship be done the way he demands, and that in this passage, he is not accepting the worship of these people because they are cheating God. They're bringing lame, sick animals to the sacrifice. They are they're dishonoring God. They bring to God animals that they would not bring to their governor. So they're dishonoring to God. So, and then there's a curse for those who cheat God in their worship. So there are consequences for giving worshiping God with worship that is unacceptable. So, okay, and let's move this back down to the...
Did you want to add anything?
Did you want to add anything, Mom? Put that by your mouth.
Yeah. But God knows our hearts. We can always ask our mouth and our behavior. God can always, he knows what's thinking. And when we please him and agree with his ways, he's very happy with us. But he's very unhappy when we don't obey and we don't love him sincerely. And he just reminded them that in the end, there was going to be a king who would come and rule forever. Mm-hmm.
Okay, finally, Dennis and Laura. Oh, here, we'll pass the Zoom group down.
Fasten your seatbelts. There you go.
This is an e-ticket ride.
We had Revelations 5, 1 through 14, and excuse me, it's a scene in heaven where they're looking for somebody that is worthy to open the scroll. Excuse me. And, you know, they didn't find anybody. And then I guess the people that he was talking to says, "Weep no more, because the Lion of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, so he can open it and its seven seals." So in here it says why Jesus was worthy, because he was slain, and by his blood he ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and nation, and made a kingdom of priests to God. So, and he's worthy because of this, and it talks about how in the worship that myriads and myriads and thousands of living creatures and those that were on the earth and under the earth and in the sea and all over, so everybody is worshiping, and it talks about them falling down. And I don't know if that's on their knees or on their face, but they are just falling down before God because he's worthy. And in the end of the verse here, you know, the scene is in heaven, and everyone in unison is saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." And it's just... And again, it talks about in verse 14 and how the elders fell down in worship again. So because of what he's done, you know, why we worship, because he is the one that's worthy. He's the only one that's worthy, because it points out in the beginning how no one was found to even open the scroll. And then it says, wait, but there's Jesus, the Lamb. And, you know, so I just get this picture of us in heaven, that we're all going to be saying this in unison, and we're going to either be on our knees or on our faces or whatever. So there's a lot of verbal praises and stuff, but there's also physical, like mm-hmm. dancing and, you know, falling down before the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first part showed who was to be worshipped, and then the second was who was worshiping, which was everyone, mm-hmm. everything. And even the angels were singing. And it just showed different types of worship. And just like I said, the only thing I asked about was where the Holy Spirit was. I guess he was out there amongst the... Mm-hmm. But... again, I was like, showed who to worship and who everyone else was doing the worshiping in different types.
Yeah, good. Okay, you can turn that off or whatever. Okay, well, very good. Okay, yep. Come on back. So let me just summarize. Obviously I did a little work beforehand, and you guys found lots of the stuff that I found. And let me summarize what worship includes. This is our sort of our definition of what's happening in worship. Worship, there's homage or allegiance to and dependence on a superior, somebody who is greater than us, in this case, the God who created us. So there's a recognition of his, the fact that we're dependent on him and he created us. Homage and allegiance to a superior. There's gratitude to him for the acts that he did in history that were for the benefit of the worshiper. You have the covenant with Noah. You have a covenant with Adam and Eve right at the beginning, and the promise in Genesis 3:15 of a savior coming from the seed of Adam. You have the Noah covenant. You have the covenant with Abraham, making a people for himself. You have the covenant with the Mosaic covenant that gives the law. You have the Davidic covenant that the Messiah will be in the line of David and will rule forever. And then you have the new covenant. These are all things that God did in history. And so worship is not something we do. It's a response to something God has done. And we're going to talk about that in the next session. And so there's gratitude for what he has done for us. And then, and mixed with this is also adoration for his character and his excellence of his being. He is worthy for what he's done, but he's worthy because of who he is. And there's no one like our God in excellence, goodness, love, power, holiness. You can go on. And the last session tomorrow, we'll be talking about the attributes of God. But this worship can be done in many ways, physically through dance, artistically through music. It can be done individually and corporately. And our worship can be accepted by God or rejected by God. And we'll talk about that next here. And so when we read David in Psalm 84:10 says, "For a day in your courts is better than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness." And the house of my God is where the courts of the tabernacle and eventually the temple, and that's where the presence of the Lord was. You know, as a kid, I thought, man, that sounds boring just to be in church every day. What he's saying is, if I can be with God, that's better than anything. That's being satisfied in his presence. So let's just take a short break, and then we're going to look at the characteristics of humans and what's wrong with unacceptable worship, because that'll help us understand true worship. So if you need to stretch your knee or whatever, go do that.
We'll be right back, guys.
Yeah, so let's just take like a 10-minute break.
Does anybody want coffee?
Okay, you're recording.
Very good.
Welcome back.
So we're making our way to talking about worship in the Old Testament, but we're going to first start with creation. And then look at unacceptable worship before we get to acceptable worship. And we know from Scripture that humans were created for worship. We see that stated in Revelation 4:11. It says, "Worthy you are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created." So what was the will of God for creation? Paul says in Colossians 1:16, "For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him." So we exist to worship him. We exist for his pleasure. How is creation for him? It reflects his glory. That was the whole point of creation. God had no need for creation. He didn't create out of some lack. He wasn't lonely. He didn't need to see what his powers were. It was an overflowing of his love to reflect his greatness and glory back to himself. And so God is perfect and complete and has no needs. Within the Godhead, each member of the Godhead is giving self in love and glorifying the other. And so God gains glory by sharing his life with his creation. But he doesn't need this glory, but it is grace, because of his greatness and excellence, that all glory goes to or is for him. And Paul says in Romans 11:36, "For from him and through him and to him are all things, to him be glory forever." And I mean, this is a concept that's if we saw a human requesting all this, we would think that's a narcissist. But because everybody that we see is a created being, God is the uncreated being. So glory belongs to him, because there's no other creature, no other being, nor the person like him. And so God created Adam and Eve in his image. All the other animals reflect his glory, but humans do in a different way. Because he created persons who could willingly love and worship God in creation, in part through their taking care of creation. They had a job to take care of creation. But creation wasn't cursed at that point. It wasn't a job that was hard. It was a job where all needs were met. There was great joy in doing it. And Adam and Eve had face-to-face communion with God in the cool of the day. And so the will of God for creating Adam and Eve was to reflect his glory through caretakers that in their role in creation represented God. Isaiah 43:6-7 just reemphasizes this. "I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the end of the earth, everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made." And this is part of the worship, because part of our worship of God is acknowledge him as our creator. We are subservient to him. We are created for his glory. Our allegiance should be directed at him. And so in the fall, humans lost their deepest purpose, which is to worship God. We think of the fall as introducing sin, which broke the relationship, but it did break the relationship. But part of breaking that relationship was stealing or defacing or losing our purpose for what we were created. By disobeying God, we could no longer be in face-to-face communion with God without being destroyed by his goodness and holiness. God's character will destroy anything that is not holy as he is holy. His creation before the fall was marked by his goodness and his holiness, and Adam and Eve were untested, but in face-to-face communion with him. After the fall, that face-to-face communion was broken. But the situation now as fallen beings is that humans still long to worship. We cannot not worship. We are always looking for someone or something to worship, something beyond ourselves. We're drawn to mystery. We're drawn to the unknown. We're drawn to something that is greater than us, that is outside of us. And humans are very adept at finding and creating things to worship. There can be a great cause, another person. You know, there have been people all through history who have been worshipped. I was having a conversation with some people about Haile Selassie. I don't know if you were in this conversation, Glenn, but you know, Haile Selassie is worshipped by Rastafarians.
Yes.
And you know, he was just a man. He died, but he's still worshipped because we always want to worship something. People worship their possessions or their status or their power. People worship nature. You know, you got a lot of that now with people, particularly as our society becomes more technologically based, and people don't like that, and they look to worship nature. And you can have people with pantheistic ideas, you know, that the God is everything, borrowing from Hindu ideas. You can have a race or cultural identity be the source of worship. That was at the heart of Nazi Germany, to worship the ideal of the ideal German, the Aryan, and to purge that race from any other. The race was worshipped. Your religion, whatever it is, can be the focus of worship. And people can worship God and intend to be worshiping God and not know Him. Because humans are designed to worship. Many years ago, when I was in graduate school, I had a friend who was not a Christian, and we spent a lot of time talking about it. And he told me one time, he taught me how to do a fly rod, and he went fly fishing. He said, "Yeah, it's really great. I go out and up in the mountains. I do this." And he said, "I've been doing it for 3 years. I'm getting really good at it." And I said, "How many fish have you caught?" He said, "I've never caught a fish." And I thought, that's not the kind of fishing I want to do. But we spent a lot of time talking. He was sort of interested in Hindu ideas. And I said, you know, we had lots of discussions. At one point he said, "Well, Jim, you'd be pleased. I've started praying." I said, "Who are you praying to?" He says, "I don't know. I'm just praying." I said, "Well, that's really dangerous. Yeah. You don't know who you're praying to." Yeah. You know, but he wanted to worship. But our worship is not acceptable to God the way we are after the fall, because we're cut off for Him, destined for death because we rebelled against Him. And so the whole flow of Scripture is a story of how God works through human history to bring us to a place where our worship can be acceptable to Him. And I think that's a legitimate way to look at the flow of history. Redemptive history is redeeming us so we can worship God the way we were originally intended. And so, but we see, particularly in the Old Testament, worship that was not acceptable to God. And I think this is really fascinating. We see this right at the beginning. God accepted Abel's offering, but not Cain's offering. Genesis 4:3-7. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it." So Cain's offering, his worship, was not accepted. What was right with Abel's offering? What was wrong with Cain's offering? Any ideas?
Well, since later on, God did prescribe grain offerings and things like that, the difference would be Cain's attitude.
Okay, so grain offerings were prescribed later, but the difference was, yeah, later on. So Cain's offering, what was unacceptable was how he offered it.
How he offered it.
Yeah. The but Abel's offering did recognize the importance of death as part of worship, of the sacrifice.
True.
And the question that we don't know was Cain aware of that and just chose not to respond to that? You know, that he knew an offering needed to have a sacrifice. There needed to be a substitute death in order to be able to come before God. And was he not, did he not acknowledge that? And that piece we don't know. But Abel's offering recognized the fact of what was required to be able to stand before God, because you had to have a substitute death for your death to be able to be before God. And Abel's Cain's offering was more like the pagan offering to a fertility god. Those offerings were often done to try to manipulate or appease or control a god. So we're going to talk about a little bit more. But we've got a couple examples of unaccepted offering. Exodus 32, the story of the people of Israel worshiping the golden calf. And we'll read verses 1 to 10. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, for your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed it and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'" And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you." So what was wrong with the worship of the golden calf? Because it's clear they say, "This is the Lord who brought you out of Egypt." What's wrong with that?
Wasn't the Lord.
It
was a disobedience to the commandment of not making a
graven image.
Yeah. Trying to form God into an image that they could see.
Yeah. And what was the problem with making an image that they could see that represented God?
Because he already made images.
Can God be represented by an image on earth? No, it dishonors God to use something he created to represent him. God is transcendent of creation. He sustains and so is immanent, but he is external. He's transcendent of creation. To use a thing he created, a golden calf, an image, to represent him was to use something he created to represent the one who was the creator. That was dishonoring and a violation of the commandment, no graven images. And so in a way, their worship again was like pagan worship, where it was required a physical object. Because in pagan worship, that physical object was sort of the doorway to having access to the supernatural world. You worship that, and that object represented the spiritual reality or the supernatural reality. We'll talk about this a little bit, why I'm using that word particularly. Because an idol, even though it has power, it's something we can control. It's not a God to whom we bow down in submission. It's a God that we can sort of wrestle with and trick and manipulate and control for our purposes. So, and then the passage in Malachi that Mom and I dealt with, where people are bringing offerings that are blemished, that are not what was commanded. And that worship wasn't accepted because it disrespected God's holiness. It said God's holiness is not important. He says, give me an unblemished male lamb. Well, I can give him a sick one. Or I can give one that was killed by the bear and give it in. It's already dead. They're going through the motions, but their hearts are not given to God.
That's supposed to be Malachi 1, correct?
Yeah, probably.
1:16-14.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I'm dyslexic in my typing.
Tell the Zoom people.
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about Malachi 1, is it 6-14?
Yes.
Yeah, and I have 6:1-14 in the notes. So what's the difference between pagan worship and worship acceptable to God? Pagan gods were located geographically. There was a god of the creek, of the mountain, the hill, the grove. They were part of the world, but beyond our part of it. So that they were supernatural. They were outside of our realm of created being, but they were still within the world that we would say is created. And knowing that name, the god's name gave the worshiper influence over the god. And pagan worship was designed to appease or manipulate the gods so that humans could get what they wanted from the gods. Gods had power, but humans worshiped them in order to use that power for their own ends. Mm-hmm. That's very different from Hebrew worship in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, Hebrew worship was always in response to God's action or revelation. Worship began with something that God did. And we mentioned the covenant, the Exodus, the law, the promises of the Messiah. Hebrew worship made God sovereign over all. There was no problem in the pagan world to have multiple gods. There was no disloyalty to one God if you also worshiped other gods. Because maybe while I'm in this city, they've got this God and I worship him here. And over here, they've got a different God and I worship her there. There was no allegiance to the God in the sense that where the Hebrew said, God is sovereign, there is no other. When Paul is on Mars Hill, that's his point, is this God, the unknown God, is the one God who has created everything. The Hebrew worship always responds to God's action or revelation, and that God was sovereign, creator, sustainer of all, worthy of worship because of his might and his goodness and his power. But he was not part of the world. He's outside the world. He can influence. He has power in this world because he's the creator. He has the power of the creator. But he is not connected to this world in any way that limits him and not based upon his need at all. If you are familiar with pagan gods, they were like superhumans, but with all the arrogance and fears and anxieties and greed of humans. They were not really ideal people. The Hebrew worship God who was sovereign, and Hebrew worship was acceptable to God if it was done in the ways he required that honored his holiness, in genuine submission to God with a sacrifice. And this is what we then will find in the Old Testament as we look at the worship in the tabernacle, how the God through Moses gave to Moses the model for the tabernacle, and that was acceptable worship. So there, it's possible for people to worship God, and but not do it acceptably. So any questions on this or reactions?
Jim?
Yes, ma'am.
I was thinking during this evening how much what a part creation plays in the worship of God. I mean, it comes back to God created and the earth and all that. And then in our modern world, that is one of the strongest areas that Satan has used to weaken who God is.
Yeah.
So, because we say, no, God didn't create the world.
Right.
Not we, but the current culture.
Right, right.
And once you, and when you see all those passages that we did, I mean, creation and nature and created works came up all the time.
Yes.
And when you take that out of the picture, what happens to worship? It crumbles.
Yeah. Yeah, because you
so transcendent being, as you were saying, but I just, Satan is so crafty, or I mean, to have taken away so that we question that God, there is a God who creates. Because once you lessen God to something other than that, it's easy to ignore or to try to manipulate God
right.
for your ends, you know, that kind of
right. Or to claim he has no claim on us, or he's irrelevant. Yeah, some people talk about the modern world has disenchanted the world, meaning we don't see any spiritual realities that work in the created order. And there's a way that's true, but there's a way that it's false, because paganism, it lived in an enchanted world. There were supernatural powers out there that you had to be careful about, because they could hurt you, they could manipulate you. So your goal was to be smarter and stronger or savvier than they were. The created world is, for Christians, not a repository of unknown spiritual beings. It is an expression of God's goodness. And so that's why Western culture in particular, the developed science, came out of deep Christian belief that God created a world that was orderly, that could be understood, that part of our desire to care for it was to understand how it worked and use it in ways that were beneficial to humans. But we end up in a culture now that's lost the sort of metaphysical Christian foundation for science, and now science sees the world purely as what can we do? It becomes the field in which we establish our sovereignty. You know, so that's why, you know, well, yeah, we can take somebody born as a girl and turn them into a boy and vice versa. You know, we can do all these things because our technology, but everything becomes just an object. There's no care or love for creation. And I think that's something that I think should mark Christians, that we love creation, because in it, even though it's fallen, we see the goodness of God. When God created the world, he looked at it and said, this is good. And so I think that's a minority view in our culture now. If now the people talk about loving creation, see it as sort of they see it as somehow sacred, and want to imbue it with spiritual power, and that's not a Christian view. It's created to show God's goodness, but God, the sovereign who created it, that's the one we worship, not creation. Yeah. You see why worship is, what you worship is really important.
Yeah. something that's been kind of going through all this discussion is the idea of sacrifice as worship. And, you know, we saw it in Genesis and in Exodus and Malachi, and it's all through the Old Testament. But we don't realize that sacrifice is also in the New Testament, that blood sacrifice has been made once and for all. There's no longer a requirement for blood. That Jesus' blood has been shed for our mm-hmm. sins and covers us in that regard. But God still loves sacrifice. And quite often, Christians, when we give our leftovers and our loose change and what we don't really need, and we don't actually make a sacrifice. And I think when we just kind of give of our pocket change, like, well, you know, you're visiting another church and the offering comes around and you open your wallet, well, there's a $5 bill in there, I put that in and that's good enough. And that's not really worship. It's a good thing to do, but it's not worship the way it is when you plan ahead and say, okay, I'm going to give up this so that I can give that to God. And that's really an act of worship. And, you know, Paul went into great detail in 2 Corinthians about that in chapters 8 and 9. It's a great passage if you want to learn about giving and godly giving. So that's also an aspect of worship that we often don't think about.
Yeah, good. Thanks. Anybody else? Any comments or reactions? Okay, well, let's push on a little bit more. And just start the section on Old Testament worship in the tabernacle. So after the fall, Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden, and God began to teach people how to worship him, and some of the things that he did. The covenant with Abraham began the process of electing a people designed and created to worship him. He began to call a people, a specific people, to worship him. A lot of people have trouble with the fact that, you know, we would say the Jewish people are chosen by God. I remember hearing a Palestinian comedian say, the Jews think they're the chosen people of God. They live in a desert. The Arabs think they're the chosen of God. They live in a desert. I think the people chose should be living in Tahiti. And so he was electing a people, calling a people to worship him. So the covenant with Abraham, Genesis 17:1-7 says, when Abraham was 99 years old, you're getting close, Mom, and the Lord appeared to Abraham and said to him, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly. Then Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. Now, we hear this. What did Abraham have to do?
Nothing.
This is all God. God saying, I chose you, and this is what I'm going to do for you. And it's not like he said, oh, I've looked around, and you're the most worthy, Abraham. It's not at all what happened. It's just, I'm going to do this. Who knows why he chose Abraham? But, you know, he's made a covenant. And a covenant is they are in a relationship. And in a covenant, each side has responsibilities. But primarily, Abraham's responsibility is just to obey, and God does everything else. He'll make him a nation, make him multiply, have kings, and there'll be an everlasting covenant. And so this is God starting the process. Now, this often offends a lot of people that God would choose a particular people. They're thinking, well, how about all the people who were living in China at that time or Africa? Why didn't he choose them? How come? We want equity. You know, everybody should have a chance. Well, I think in God's plan, everybody does have a chance. But what we forget, God made a creation with specific animals, plants. There are details, and we in our Western world often can think in terms of generalizations rather than particularity. And he chose a particular person because God created each item to be different from each, and that's how he does things. There's no, the fact that he chose one people should not be something against what God has done. It just seems to be how God does things. You know, you read the creation account, and it lists all the different all the things that he created. You look at when he talks about Solomon and his wisdom. He talks about Solomon's wisdom. He knew all plants and animals. He knew all the particularities of God's creation. You know, and the nice thing about, I mean, the thing that's important there is he loved each of us particularly. You know, the particular, the individual item and person is important to God. And sometimes our modern world wants abstractions and object. How come he chose Dennis and not me? In God's providence, he knew what he was doing. And so he begins with Abraham to create a people for himself. And you know the story, Abraham and has Isaac, who then has Jacob. You've got low battery. Uh-oh. Zoom, we're going to plug you in here a second. With Joseph, they move down to Egypt. And then the Exodus begins to shape this people into a nation. You have a people who are chosen by God, but they're not a nation yet. There are people who follow God. We don't know much about, well, we know they did altars, there were sacrifice, but we don't know really the particulars of that. And we have interesting things like where Abraham runs into Melchizedek, and we don't know who Melchizedek was and how he was a priest of God, but Hebrews makes a big deal of him. So there's a lot we don't know, but we know God's bringing a people to call to worship him, and then he creates them into a nation that is designed, their purpose for the nation is to worship God. Moses tells Pharaoh, Exodus 4:23, let my people go so that they may worship me. They're trying to be faithful to God's call in their life to worship him. So God elects a people called to worship him. And then when he brings the people of Israel out to create a nation, he creates a priesthood to mediate that worship. Given the law given at Sinai, and that began the Jewish priesthood through Abraham. And Exodus 19:6, God says, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So a people, electing a people, then creating a priesthood who protect and act out the things of worship that are acceptable to God. And then in the Exodus, they construct a tabernacle that is a place of worship through sacrifices. And this is really interesting. We're going to go through Exodus, starting with Exodus 19, because we have God calling Moses up to Mount Sinai, and then we have a lot of the law, and then there's some other movement up Mount Sinai. And so let's just make our way through this. So in Exodus 19, God calls Moses up to Mount Sinai to give him the law. And before he goes up, Moses prepares the people for what they will experience when God's presence descends on the mountain, making it holy ground. When Moses goes up, God comes down, and that mountain becomes holy. And so there's a fence put up to keep people off the mountain, because they will, if they step on the mountain, God will destroy, his holiness will destroy them. So there's a fence, and they put an altar there. Moses goes up, receives the Ten Commandments, other parts of the law, and comes down and reports on the law. And so 20, 21, 22, 23 of Exodus is a lot of the law. And then in Exodus 24, we see that God invites Moses and Aaron with 70 leaders to come partway up the mountain to be with God. So the motion is, God says, come up here, this mountain is holy, there's a fence. People cannot come here, only Moses can come. Then Moses comes back with the law, and then God says, okay, Moses, you, Aaron, and the 70 leaders, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 leaders, you come up partway. And Exodus 24, 9 to 11 says, then Moses and Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. They were under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. Similar to the description we see of Christ in the Revelation. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. So they go partway up, and they see God, and they eat and drink. So they're in his presence. Then Moses goes up further the mountain in God's presence for 40 days and 40 nights, and gives him the stone tablets and the pattern for the tabernacle. So Exodus 25, 8 to 9 says, let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst, exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and of all its furniture, so you shall make it. So Moses goes up, Moses is going to go up, puts up a fence and an altar. Then he goes up, he comes back down, he takes people partway up, then he goes all the way, comes back with the Ten Commandments and the tablet, comes down and says, we're going to build a tabernacle. Here's what's really interesting. In the tabernacle, or the flow of people towards God in the tabernacle, matched the movement of people up the mountain. So there's three stages of ascent up the mountain. The three stages of ascent up the mountain are recreated in the tabernacle. So the altar in the outer court corresponds to the altar at the foot of the mountain, where all worshipers could come to present sacrifices. Then the priests who represented the people who could eat and drink in the holy place, as the elders had feasted, they can be in the part where the sacrifices are done. And then the high priest can enter the Holy of Holies once a year, sort of retracing Moses' ascent to the summit in the presence of the Lord. And he represented the people by having the names of the tribes written on the gems on his vest and wearing a headband that says, Holy unto the Lord. And so the movement of people, only the high priest, like only Moses could go be closest to God. Only the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies. So you had the outer court, and then there were greater demands of holiness as you moved. And as you know, the high priest could go, but had to have sacrifice for him, for all people, a rope tied around his foot, bells so they know he's moving, and he could only go there once a year. When the tabernacle is completed, what happens? The glory of the Lord comes and is in the Holy of Holies. So Exodus 40, 34 and 35. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So God has, in the tabernacle, created a place where humans can come and worship in God's presence in a way that is acceptable to God. And so God in the tabernacle became God with us. Not God off there anymore, but God with us. But you couldn't just wander in. You couldn't even, one of the kings later tries to burn incense and is ushered out of the temple. The king could not burn incense in the tabernacle. He was not authorized by God to do that. And so because God's presence is there, but everything that he set up there was done in a way to protect the honor of his holiness and protect us from the way his holiness would destroy humans who were not holy. He provided a way that we know as Christians was temporary, but for humans to be in the presence of God. And it is in the presence of God where we worship. Other things about the tabernacle. What direction did the tabernacle face?
East.
Why did it face east? Yeah. Because the Garden of Eden was in the east. He was recreating, sort of metaphorically, the Garden of Eden. What were the decorations on the curtains all around and on the walls?
Pomegranates.
Yeah, trees and plants like the Garden of Eden. What stood above the Ark of the Covenant? Cherubim. And the figures were also woven into the curtain marking off the Holy of Holies. And if you remember, the cherubim were the ones who guarded the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve were kicked out.
Seraphim.
So what's that?
And the seraphim?
Yeah, seraphim.
And there's a cherubim that guarded the...
Yeah. Okay, sorry, I got my angels mixed up. And so... The priesthood revealed a theology of reconciliation that gave access to Eden again. And so we say the new heaven and the new earth when Christ comes back is going to be like that, but it's going to be better. And here's another interesting thing. Adam is told to work and keep the garden. And those words could also be translated as to minister and guard the garden, which is the words that are used for the service of the priests. They're to minister and guard. And so they are serving in the tabernacle the way Adam did in the garden, and the way, and we're going to see when we talk about the New Testament, worship in the New Testament, how Christ is the second Adam who ministers to us and guards us. And another thing, the tabernacle represented Eden, and Eden existed, obviously, before the people of Israel existed as a nation. So the fact that they are a nation is the nation was created to worship. All of this law, the Jewish people, when we see in the New Testament, treated it as their exclusive domain, but the whole purpose of it was to invite everybody, which includes all of us, who I don't know of any of us here who have any Jewish heritage. We might. We know of. And so worship exists from the creation of the nation. The worship of God was exclusive to the people of Israel, except those proselytes and those believers who could come in and be accepted in Jewish worship. But it was not to be the exclusive possession of Israel forever. It was creating a people who represented God and then showed to the world how God was there and how it was possible for everybody to have a relationship with God. And so the priests represented the people, but the core of their service was to be in the presence of God. And I think they are representing what is possible in the new covenant for everybody to be in the presence of God. And then,
the psalm that we did, it talked about Israel, but then it also said kept saying the phrase, and all the nations.
Yeah, and all the nations.
So that there was that inclusion. So that's us, you know, if we're talking about all the nations, it includes us.
Yeah. Yeah, so the nation of Israel really created to be servants, representing and showing a life of acceptable worship to God before all the nations as a sort of a picture of what would be available to all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And part of the problem, they saw it so much as their exclusive righteousness, they didn't understand who Christ was. They didn't understand what God was trying to do. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Pharisees got such, at least in Matthew, such harsh response from Christ. They didn't understand what God had been doing through all these people.
Right. Verse 24, that in Psalm, it was in Chronicles. I think there's a Psalm
The
Chronicles. It's the same. It's the same exact wording. I think it's 78. But anyway, in verse 24, it says, we're supposed to sing to the Lord. Tell of his salvation, declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples.
Yeah.
That was one of the jobs of the Israelites, to be that representative to everybody, to the whole world.
Yeah, and the leaders in Jesus' day absolutely refused to do that.
Right, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. right. Now, later, Solomon builds a temple using pattern that was based on the tabernacle, but with ideas that David had and lots of the materials David put together. And this time, it was modeled on the tabernacle, but made of stone and wood, not of cloth and leather. So it was a more substantial.
It was permanent, not packable.
Yeah. And that temple became the new place for God's presence. When the priests bring in the Ark of the Covenant into the Holy of Holies in the temple, 1 Kings 8, 9, 10 to 11 says, "And when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord." Just like what happened with the tabernacle. Mm-hmm. We see how God is working all through history to bring this people who show the world how to worship God in an acceptable way that recognizes God's holiness and provides a way for unholy people to safely worship Him. So now, tomorrow, we're going to look at how this gets fulfilled and how it changes in the New Testament. And so we'll look at that, and then we will we'll spend a lot of time looking at that, and then we will look at the character of God, nature and character of God. So we've been looking at what God is, you know, we focus more on what God has done for us, you know, the Thanksgiving and gratitude for what He's done for us. And we'll continue that. We look at Christ, and then we'll look at why He is worthy of worship just for who He is. So any comments or reactions or?
Been tremendous.
Well, good.
Thank you.
Really good.
Good.
I don't think it's all encompassing, like the whole thing, but it is interesting.
because you started off, I guess that's where my mind is, like when you started off with the Psalm 17, 15, talking yeah. about the likeness.
Yeah.
And how you mentioned that being like mere presence.
Yeah.
But that's also this idea of being likeness is we do get from, we are out of all creation.
Right.
We weren't just, not just made, what did you say? Not just made for, what did you, what was the contrast you made between creation and mankind?
Okay, creation shows the goodness of God while we are to be in face-to-face worship of God.
Right.
Representing him in creation.
Right, so that, yeah, that aspect of, like that nearness, that representation of him.
Yeah.
Likeness, all these various things, like, as I've been kind of like thinking through everything that's being said of just like thinking about how I made a little note. And like I said, this isn't all encompassing, but it was like something that popped in my head. But it was, I feel the greatest, well, this is personal experience, but like when I think about the times where I probably was in the time of, great sense of worship, of course, that always involves like being in awe of him, right? It's,
right.
It's directed towards
right.
him, but it's like a recognition of, or a great sense of worship when I see and experience his image in me and in others.
Yeah.
By like his character being displayed.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
His character through my life, his character through other people's life. Meditating on his character, like we've noticed in all these different psalms and other passages, he has done this, he's
yeah.
done that, how great are his works, all these things. The law reveals his character,
right.
his protection, his watching over us. Hey, do it this way, his particular of what's acceptable.
Yeah.
It reveals his character. And then so what popped in my mind was the greatest, so then when we were down here talking about like when God chose, started, obviously it was even in the workings, but when his plan of redemption really starts to unfold all the more through the calling of Abraham, it's almost like what you see is he calls Abraham and he chose a people group to start restoring mm-hmm. that image and
right.
that likeness.
Right.
So that the world around Abraham, As God is in relationship with Abraham, and Abraham is in the fear of the Lord and in awe of him and in relationship with him,
right.
Abraham's character starts to transform to be more like
yep.
the Lord's. And then they are the light to the world. Hopefully then
yeah.
the world starts seeing God's character through Abraham. And then obviously, so it's like this constant restoration of image.
Right.
But then what I wrote the little thing is the greatest form of flattery is imitation.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, one of the greatest expressions of our worship is to be, like, so in awe of who God is. Not that we, like, seek to be like him in the sense of, like, glory glad
right.
and thinking we're going to
right.
I'm like God, but, like, being like him, reflecting his character.
Yeah.
And the only way you really do that is by really knowing
right.
that person.
Right, right.
So when you have all of these fans, like people who imitate, like might you see people imitating
yeah.
Michael Jackson,
yeah.
all these various people dressed up just like
yeah.
They even do, some go to the extent of getting the plastic surgery. They
yep.
talk like them, do the dance moves. It's because they are worshiping
yep.
Michael Jackson. And in their mind, there's nothing greater and no greater joy than being like him.
Yeah, yeah.
So thinking about how I made another note, which I, which is, because you were talking about how we all worship, like it's
yeah.
something we'll never escape.
Yeah, right.
Everyone worships. So I wrote, we all worship because it sparks life in us, and we never experience the truest spark of life lest we worship the Lord. So like,
yeah.
you know, like that's, I was talking, actually, what's interesting is, Ryan, when he came,
yeah.
he asked me a question about worship, and we were out on your dock talking, and how, like, there is a certain experience of joy that is a very deep sense of joy that only is expressed in worship.
Yeah.
That's why sometimes we are self-centered and we worship ourselves, worship others, right? When your kid does really good at a sport or your favorite sport team wins the Super Bowl, you erupt in a sense of joy that is deep down, but it's brought out through worship. And so like that deepest part of us, that like such an intimate form of joy that gets brought out is through worship. Well, think of how awesome and amazing you can experience that if the Lord himself is the object of the worship.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to say object.
Objectify
him.
Yeah, but.
You get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'll stop talking.
Yeah. Well, good.
That's kind of, as I was trying to follow the likeness.
Yeah.
Start and kind of how that bleeds through all of this.
Yeah, for sure.
I thought it was really insightful.
Well, good. Well, we'll pick it up tomorrow, 9 o'clock here.